Todd, say hello and welcome. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Wind Speaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Trombley, and it's CGOT soon. And on today's episode, I continue my conversation with Buffalo Lake Métis Settlement's Wally Desjardins. And I just remember, too, just recalling when I was young, right? Because I grew up listening to CFWE, and you were working at the time. Because I remember just hearing your name all the time, but never putting name to face until I met you in person. The first time I met you was in Buffalo Lake when I started in my career. And I remember growing up in Beaver Lake Cree Nation, Buffalo Lake, and all that. And my Uncle Pete was a very huge fan of CFWE. And he would say to me, he'd say, that's your relative who's on the radio station. And I said, who? And he goes, Wally, that's your relative on your mom's side. And I was like, ho. I was like, yeah. And he would be like, you should get, like, he never told me to go to radio or whatever else, but I know that, like, you know, before he passed away, you know, because he was a guy that worked within the Beaver Lake community and stuff like that. He always listened to that station in his truck when he was out going digging grade holes and to work on houses in the reserve. He would always tell me, he said, like, when he found out that I had gotten the job, the last thing he said to me was, I love you there, Monkey Man, and I can't wait to see you or hear you on the radio when you start working there. He passed away, sadly, just before I made my first ever voicer or just heard across CFWE airwaves. And, you know, just to hear, like, how you started and how you paved the way for many others to follow in your footsteps, Wally, is phenomenal. And, you know, I was listening to your celebration of 20 years at CFWE and how everyone was just all happy for you and everything else. And the famous laugh, of course. And the best thing that came from that was that the one thing that was brought up by Kimberly, if you remember her, she said, like, you know, you have this way of connecting with people for, you know, when it comes to request shows and stuff like that. Like you mentioned, you know how to talk to the people, and it helps for being from Buffalo Lake, and you just knew him by name. So, like, for, you know, with you being in the industry for so long that you have been, what would your advice be to up-and-coming radio people, whether they be Indigenous or non-Indigenous, to make a huge impact in their community with whatever station they may be with, or possibly that are new with us, because we have a lot of new people that work for Wind Speaker today?
You know, the first thing I would tell anybody out there, if they're just starting out, whether or not, ego. Don't walk in with a big head thinking that you're all that, because you're not. You're just like everybody else. And that's how I've always been. I've always just been humble. I've just been myself. You know, get in there. Go to school, do whatever training that you're doing if you're not going to school, and listen and follow and, you know, pay attention. And when I was growing up, people have always asked me, why CFWE? Like, you could have applied for other stations. I said, I'm at home here. And it not had anything to do with the fact that, you know, I had a safe job. I mean, it's like any job. You screw up, you do something wrong, boom, you could be out the door, right?
Yeah.
But I've always just been myself and done the tasks that I was assigned. And again, just making that connection with the listeners. And that was the one thing that I really enjoyed through having our request show, was talking to our listeners. And there were so many that would call that, I mean, as soon as their voice came on, I knew who they were. And I've had so many throughout the years that had commented and mentioned as to how much they enjoy listening to me. And I said, what is it that I do that keeps you listening? They said, you're yourself. And you know the humble backgrounds that, you know, we come from, which is true. I mean, I've never ever had this big head on my shoulders. I mean, I would be the one who would be shaking when an artist would be coming in because
no way.
I was so anxious and yet nervous. But then as soon as you meet them, again, they're like us. They're just human beings
mm-hmm.
who are in the music industry, who are well known, you know, throughout the whole continent, let's just say. And then when you sit down with them and have a talk with them, it's amazing. I remember, and I don't mean to shout out any names here, but I had one time, interviewed, I think, probably just about everybody under the sun. But one of my best interviews was with Wynonna Judd when I had a chance to interview her while I was working at the station. After we had got off the call, she was still on the line because her assistant came on and said that Wynonna wants to speak with you. And I thought, oh.
Wow.
I got on the line with her, and she thanked me. She thanked me for the interview and had commented that it was one of the best that she's had in a long time because she said we were just having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, it just totally went over my head that I was actually doing a live interview. But she said it just felt like it was somebody that I knew that we were just having a daily conversation with. So, I mean, something like that, that's where I kind of, you know, stood up and made me feel proud of what I've been able to accomplish with all the help and all the work through CFWE. And if it was anything, the one thing that I really, really had supported was our Indigenous artists and non-Indigenous artists, independent artists that were coming up that were from here in Alberta or maybe elsewhere that, you know, were just starting out and then look where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Brett Kissel, take him for advantage. Look where he is now. And we have a recording of him that we did in St. Paul when he was just a young guy. He did the Auctioneer song
by
Leroy Van Dyke. And we played that for him when we had him in the studio one time. It was a surprise. And you should have seen the expression on his face when we played that. I mean, you know, stuff like that are for other people might think, oh well, you know, mm-hmm. who cares? But for me, it just goes to show that I was doing my job.
Yeah.
And I was doing it with the help and cooperation, not just for me, but from the other staff as well. Because when you go on that mic, you got to realize that there are a lot of people behind the scenes that are helping you sound better. And to, you know, just give you that confidence and help you out with any information that you might have missed up on or they might have missed up on or didn't use on their ship that they might just want to pass on. You know what I mean?
That's true.
It's a family.
And you're not wrong with the whole family part. You know, when I was in school, I was just finishing up my schooling at SAIT in Calgary. And at that time, you know, we're kind of conditioned to be prepared to be sent out to the real world. And
yeah,
of course, you know, for me, you know, I was approached by all my instructors and they said, you know, you're Métis, you're the only Indigenous representation in your graduate class. Where are you thinking of wanting to go? Because you'll get a job anywhere, right? Because of your background. And I said, well, I don't know yet. I'm still figuring out what I want to do or where I want to go. And one day I want to be a sports broadcaster, hopefully, because, you know, and if that doesn't happen, I'm not going to be too hurt about it. But it's just as long as I get a job in industry, my dad can hear me on the radio or on television. That's all I care about. And I remember my instructor, Laura, she changed my life forever in that instance. She goes, well, now that you say that, I want to slide something to you. And she gave me a sticky note, and on there said, you know, CFWE is looking. And I thought, no way. I said, are you serious? And she goes, yeah, and look at your email. And I looked at it, and there was the application or the job posting. And I was thinking, in my head, there's no way they're going to hire me. They've probably got some, you know, maybe many other Indigenous students from all over that are just chopping at the bit to get to the station, because I grew up listening to this, right? And I remember I said, okay, I'll apply, but I'm not going to hold my breath. I said, not to beat myself up, but I mean, there's probably some stiff competition out there. And sure enough, man, was I ever nervous, because I also grew up hearing Jeremy on the radio. We'll get to him in a second. and so I remember sitting in on a video call. I was on maybe 2 hours of sleep. And I remember, because, you know, getting the final assignments done or whatever else, I was in a video camera with him, a beautiful woman by the name Maureen, because she was running the LJI, the Local Journalism Initiative, and Deb Steele, who is, of course, with Windspeaker, the newsletter. And I thought to myself, I said, man, now this is really intimidating. Because, like, you got, you know, the PD from Windspeaker, you got Maureen from LGI, which is heard all across Canada, and you got Deb Steele, who she's like the news director for the Windspeaker newsletter, which has been around for neons.
And she's been with it from
day one.
For as long as I could remember, practically day one,
And so I remember sitting on that camera, I'll never forget the question, you know, Jeremy asked me, he goes, so if I was to hire you, give me a reason why I should hire you for Windspeaker. And I told him, I said, because I grew up listening to the station, I know the listeners that it pertains to, that it is the largest Indigenous radio station company, in my opinion, in all of Alberta. And that you guys started in my hometown of Lac-O-Bish. I grew up listening to that station, going up and down the roads many times over. In fact, that was a station my family grew up listening to for bus updates and stuff like that, because no one listened to Big Dog. No offense to them. But that's just my opinion. That now they're boom.
I don't think they exist.
they don't anymore.
Okay.
No. And so I remember, you know, he gave me that look, and then Deb said, we'll contact you when we let you know if you got the job or not. And I was like, okay. And we were in that call for 45 minutes, and my instructor Laura goes, that's pretty impressive, I think you got the job. I said, how do you know that? And she goes, if you didn't get that job, you would have been out of that room in say 10-15 minutes, but you were in there for 45. I wouldn't be surprised if you got the job. Now my mind started to play like tricks on me. I'm like, no, I didn't get it. I gotta mentally prepare. If I don't get it, then I have to go back to Lac-O-Bish and be a custodian again, right? And sure, and that's what I did with my dad a lot of years. And I remember on St. Paddy's Day, we're getting ready to go on to prepare our television last, you know, our last big group project together. And all of a sudden, I get a phone call, and I look at the number. I don't recognize it, but it says Edmonton underneath. And I said, who the hell's calling me from Edmonton? And I answer, I go, hello. And I go, and there's Jeremy. He goes, hey there, Daniel. It's Jeremy from Windspeaker Radio Network. You got a chance to talk for a second? I'm like, oh. So I went to like one of the production booths, and I closed the door, and I say, yeah, what's going on? And I'm thinking he's going to tell me, sorry, kid, but we went the other direction. He goes, congratulations. It's a lucky day on St. Paddy's Day. Welcome to the team. And I go, you're joking. And I remember I just started crying. I was bawling. The first people I thought of was my mom and my Uncle Pete and my family members on my mom's side and my dad. And I remember thinking, man, this is nuts. And I was the first person in my graduate class to get a job in industry with an amazing company that I've been able to do a lot of things with, especially meeting, you know, my childhood hero, Brett the Hitman Hart, when I was nervous interviewing him in the Saddle Dome. And honestly, that was the coolest thing, you know, just like with you, with your many interviews, I didn't think that he was going to say something to the lines of, if there's anything you want me to do, kid, before I leave, I'll do it for you. I was like, in fact, there is. And I FaceTimed my dad, no warning. I said, hey, Dad, someone wants to say hello to you. He grew up with me with wrestling, right? So he got me into it. And I said, there's someone that wants to say hello to you. He goes, who? And it's like 9 o'clock at night, right, in Calgary. I said, the best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be, Brett the Hitman Hart. And I turned the camera over, and there's Brett just waving, smiling at my dad. And my dad, you could just hear from the side of the phone going, holy, not going to say the word, it's Brett the Hitman Hart. And I could just hear him launch himself off the bed because he was laying in bed. He was about to go to sleep. And they talked for 15 minutes. Just casually having a conversation. Like, it was like they knew each other for years. And then Brett puts my dad on the spot. He goes, what was one of your favorite matches of mine growing up? And my dad just said a match that Brett had in St. John's, Newfoundland, I had no clue existed. And Brett goes, you're making me feel old. It's those moments that make me love what I do. And, you know, going to do the Junos, the first ever Indigenous Day celebration, to, you know, meeting you, Wally, and meeting so many others that have made huge impacts within the communities across. And, you know, it's unreal, to say the least. But it also, it shows, like, you know, my mom grew up telling me when I was young, and this is what I didn't understand because she was a survivor and so many others in my family were. And she told me, she said, like, you know, Indigenous people will never have a voice. And she passed on before the 215 discovery and the Orange Shirt Days and the Truth of Reconciliation. And so, you know, with you having the history that you've had with Windspeaker and seeing stuff like that unfold, when you saw all that unfold, and now we're seeing a huge uprise with, you know, more in, you know, inclusive, you know, being more involved within the Indigenous culture, the communities, and of course the showcasing of that, the language, and most importantly, seeing more Indigenous actors and actresses hit the big screens, and of course, you know, radio and music and incorporation with the culture and the music and stuff. When you see all this unfolding, Wally, with all the years you spent with Windspeaker, how does that all make you feel to see all that?
I say it's about bleeping time.
That's fair. That is fair. It's halfway.
No, because, I mean, we could be seen as a platform for a lot of young Indigenous people out there who want to get into radio broadcasting. I mean, if that's something they want to do, and that's something that they want to look into, I've always said, you know, if ever, let me know. Call me. Like, I would tell them to, you know, reach out to me on Facebook, and I would tell them that if they would like to come on down and come and visit the station. Because when people walk into a radio station and they've been hired, they right away think, oh, I'm going to be on the air. And boom, there goes the ego, right? I mean, the head is as bigger than the door.
Yep.
But I've not been like that, because I was brought up the proper way to learn and respect your elders. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, goes with everybody. I mean, you know, you got that ego, someone's going to come along and that's going to be popped, and boom, out the door you go.
That's true.
Because there's no place for that. Mm-hmm. If you want to engage and want to connect with the listeners, you have to be honest and truthful with yourself. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that I learned through the years of my going for therapy. just because of some trauma that I've experienced growing up, that is now just coming to light for me. And that's been a hard process. Mm-hmm. But with the work that I'm doing with CFWE and being back and being able to have programs on the weekend, that just lifts my spirits, because it gives me an opportunity to do something that I've always loved doing. Mm-hmm. And when it came to picking a job, I mean, I had the best job and the best career ever. I had no problems walking into the station every day with a smile on my face. I looked forward to going to work every day.
That was Wally Desjarlais from Buffalo Lake Métis Settlement. You're listening to the voices of our people on the Windspeaker Radio Network. I'm Daniel Barker Tremblay. Next, I continue my conversation with Stoney Nakoda First Nations, Teresa Snow. And, you know, with our conversation thus far, the topic that always comes about is passion. And you're not wrong, because passion does take you very far in this life. It was passion for me that led me to where I am today. And it's passion for those that I work alongside of that I can see every day. You know, family, friends, I always tell them the key to success is to, you know, find something you're passionate about, because you will never work a day in your life when you find that passion. And the checks, yes, the money's good or whatever, but it won't matter when you're doing something that you love 365 a year. And of course, you know, I have to ask, because with all the things that you've done, you've also done a lot of, you've received a lot of education in your time as well. You know, you hold a criminology diploma from MRU back from 1994, relating to the domestic and family violence, parenting and trauma training, and also your skill at program inception and curriculum development, where you have assisted in creating programs for Indigenous communities. And now, when you have done that for many Indigenous communities that are in need of those services, how did that feel to create those services accessible for families within those Indigenous communities?
I think within working within it, understanding that it's not a generic template, and every group, every community is going to be unique based on a few different things, and that's their area that they live in, the land resources, if there's water around, if there's mountains around, if it's trees, what is their land resource at the area, and what is the history to that land, like is there traditional herbs that they use, sacred sites that they practice, that they go to or that they're able to go to, and then also too, what is the history with settler history coming in, and what is the impact or rate of colonialism and imperialism, and how much has it affected the community in what they're able to do, and understanding too the spirituality of the community. Are they mostly traditional ceremonial people, or are they, do they follow a religion, is what is the faith in that community, and then look at the historical impacts. Was there a residential school nearby? What was the impact with 60 Scoop, with the Métis Nation? How have they been affected with it? Are they nearby? Was there a group? Was there a settlement nearby? And what is the nearest town, the urban setting to them, and how has that affected it? Because when we look at our Indigenous communities, we're often around cities or towns, and we give a lot to that, to maintain that livelihood of that town or that city, because we're constantly going there and buying food or clothing or getting our cars fixed or whatever. Because when you essentially look at reserves, they're deserts. They're a reserve desert. They have next to nothing for clothing-wise, for stores, for food. You do have a convenience store there, and the prices are often higher. And look at the quality of food in there. It's often soft drinks and chips. There's not really a lot of vegetables or food that are good for the body. And so then we have to look at that and understand, what is the needs assessment in the community? Is there a lot of opioid use? Has there been a lot of suicides? Are there nearby treatment centers? We don't have a lot of communities that have treatment centers on the reserve or long-term aftercare programs, recovery programs. And so what is the healing capacity of the community to take care of their people or meet their needs? And not only that, who in the community is working there? Is it a majority of Indigenous people from the band working there who have the training and the skill and the know-how? Because we're our best indicators of our healing. We know what helps us in our healing, and we can set forth that dream, that goal of what we're going to do of that programming. But if we have others that come in with their own perspective and their own ideas of saviorhood, that really affects our ability to help our people. And so when I'm asked to go in, I look at all these things and ask these questions. Well, what's working? What's not? And then I try to work with them with their needs assessment on what is needed in the community. And what I've seen, like since the pandemic, is we need huge amounts of grief and loss workshops for communities. We cannot expect people to get right back to employment and job employment because of the life skills that are needed. That's needed as well, too, life skills. But a majority of is grief, loss, and trauma. Because if we look at our communities today, we're going through so much continual grief and loss. There's a funeral one week, there's another the next week. We never have time to grieve that loss. And so I just see an onset of communities needing to do this for the next probably 5 years continuously. Every month, maybe you'll get 10 people, maybe the next month 20, maybe 3 the next month. But if you continuously offer these workshops or these programming for communities, you'll start to have that ripple effect, because we know everything's connected. We know everybody in a community is related. And so it's just trying to work through the needs assessment of what the community has and how it's unique. And one model does not work for another community because it's so different and distinct. And two, with language, we have to have that language in there as a part of the assessment. And so that's what I try to do when I go into communities. And it's basically creating a program for them that their workers can have, that their staff can have. And if it's facilitating or designing a program, helping them do that, to take it on their own. And in one sense, it may be working myself out of employment or a job to keep going to that community. But to me, it's strengthening that community and making them more viable and strong for their community members and their staff to have that encouragement to enhance their skills and to enhance their spirit so that they can work with their people and be the helpers in their community.
And of course, with that, you know, huge contributions towards the Indigenous communities that need those services and huge of need, I guess you could say, as well as you've done something truly remarkable as well. In 2021, you were selected to be the Alberta representative for the Working Group for the Healing Fund, which is connected with the United Church of Canada, which grants organizations monetary contributions, scholarships for Indigenous students. When you were called up and you were asked to fill in that role, and they said, "Teresa, we want you to do this role," what was the first thought that came to mind when that phone call came to you in 2021?
I was the opportunity to do that, and a blessing, because to be able to come in with cultural knowledge and knowledge from working in various communities and seeing what's working and what's not working, and then to be able to sit on a committee and look at these organizations, First Nations, individuals, agencies, submit proposals, and how is it working within their community? What do they want to see? What are the goals they have for their community? And having a national perspective of it, to make it so that it's for everybody nationally that can apply. So someone in BC or Saskatchewan, and to make sure that we're being equitable about how we do the funding and what things are working. And is it something that's proactive for the community, and where is it going? And then always trying to be that of the understanding that, how will this help the community? How will this impact the community? If I was in the community, how would this be for me? Or is this something that would fit? Or is this a great idea? And there's been really good proposals that have come through that are amazing, and that we've been able to fund them. And so I'm still on the committee. I still sit on the committee. We just met in Winnipeg in April. And so just understanding, it's a collective way for organizations, for communities to come about healing. It isn't for individual gain to do these things, the funding. It's to do it in a community with the group or with the organization. So if they're doing something like a youth camp, then that's what we want to help with. If it's doing a language study with the youth and elders, if it's doing button blanket making, if it's all these things that are healing and cultural for our people, then I think it's really good, because the church is stepping up and helping to do these things and fund these things that for many years they outlawed or that they were against. And so it's an opportunity for the church to make right of what was taken away. And what better way than to fund communities to help get these things started for healing, or these activities.
That was Stony Nakota First Nations' own Teresa Snow on Voices of Our People. I'd like to thank today's special guests for joining us, Wally Desjardins and Teresa Snow. Tune in next Thursday for more Voices of Our People on the Windspeaker Radio Network.